In this clip from a documentary on Alexander the Great, Colonel Lance Betrose discusses the power of demonstrative violence.
Alexander's attitude toward defiance was either join me or die.
Alexander begins what would become the longest and most brutal siege of his campaign. After 7 grueling months, when the walls are finally breached, 7,000 Tyrians are killed and 30,000 enslaved. To prove a point to other cities that might resist, he has 2,000 Tyrian fighters crucified.
When he was finished, he allowed the bloodlust of his men to run loose and killed virtually every male inhabitant of the fortress. It was an awful display of brutality, but it was also very effective in showing to any other potential enemies what could happen if they resisted.
Just as Alexander made an example of Tyre, the American army would make an example of Fallujah. On March 31st, 2004, 4 mercenaries working for Blackwater USA were captured and killed by the Iraqi resistance, and their bodies dragged through the streets. What followed was one of the greatest war crimes in modern history. Sealing off Fallujah and forcing adult males and teenage boys to remain, over half of the entire city was razed to the ground.
From the 2005 video, Fallujah, the Hidden Massacre.
We were told going into Fallujah, into the combat area, that every single person that was walking, talking, breathing was an enemy combatant. As such, every single person that was walking down the street or in the house was a target.
In addition to heavy artillery and 2,000-pound bombs, American troops deployed the chemical weapon White Phosphorus, which burns through human flesh like acid. The same chemical weapon was used by Israel in its 2009 assault against Gaza, a city where the majority of the population is made up of children. Depleted uranium weapons have also been used in these conflicts. Despite overwhelming evidence that they cause severe health risks and contamination of the environment. Which is putting it mildly, if we're talking about radioactive pollution that seems likely to last for millions of years to come.
Just as the spraying of Agent Orange in Vietnam would lead to an explosion in cancer rates and birth defects, the use of white phosphorus and other munitions have produced similar results in cities like Fallujah. A study from July 2010 showed a 12-fold increase in childhood cancer in the city. It also reported that an incredible 14.7% of children are now born with birth defects, more than 14 times the figure recorded for Hiroshima. In a grim irony, shortly after the Fallujah study was released, Wired magazine revealed that the U.S. military was teaching its officers at the Joint Forces Staff College to use Hiroshima tactics and wage a total war on Islam. Arabs who resist occupation with armed self-defense, or conversely, adopt the tactics of their oppressors by engaging in acts of terrorism, are widely portrayed as being motivated by religion. Yet an actual study of the subject came to the opposite conclusion. The study was conducted at the University of Chicago's Project on Security and Terrorism. Among other revelations, it revealed that more than 95% of all suicide attacks are in response to foreign occupation, not religion.
Bachman and 4 of her Republican colleagues are demanding an investigation into potential infiltration by Muslim Brotherhood operatives intent on destroying Western civilization.
Containing dangerous Muslims. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo.
It's a frightening thought. Islamic terrorist training camps right here in America in our backyards.
So we made it through the holidays without a terrorist attack, but it doesn't mean we can ever let our guard down because our enemies are persistent and they're patient. Could the hundreds of mosques in America be fronts for terror training?
Not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim.
There's a menace to that.
You've upset a billion of us. You should watch out. That's what it means. And we're going to try and move in to your city and your country, too, and we're going to raise more and more demands. That's what's meant by it.
Would you grant me this, that as long as there is an Israel in the world, and I'm a big supporter of Israel, and as long as America backs it, the kind of Muslims that take their religion that seriously, that they would strap on a suicide belt, are always going to be out for us and always going to be trying to kill us.
And the thing that worries me the most in the world is radical Islam, obviously, and increasingly, might I add, moderate Islam.
Americans are 17,600 times more likely to die from heart disease than from a terrorist attack. They're 271 times more likely to die from a workplace accident than a terrorist attack. They are more likely to be hit by lightning than to die in a terrorist attack.
The overarching narrative regarding Islam versus the West was given pseudo-intellectual justification by Samuel Huntington, a member of the elite Trilateral Commission, via his book, The Clash of Civilizations.
Edward said, literary theatrician.
It says a very brief and rather crudely articulated manual in the art of maintaining a wartime status in the minds of Americans and others that Huntington's work has to be now understood. I go so far as saying that it argues from the standpoint of Pentagon planners and defense industry executives who may have temporarily lost their occupations after the end of the Cold War but have now discovered a new vocation for themselves. But few people today with any sense would want to volunteer such sweeping characterizations as the ones advanced by Lewis about a billion Muslims scattered through five continents, dozens of differing languages and traditions and histories. Of them all, Lewis says that they are all enraged at Western modernity, as if a billion people were really only one person, and Western civilization was no more complicated a matter than a simple declarative sentence. There's a similar debate inside the Islamic world today, which in the often hysterical outcry about the threat of Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, and terrorism that one encounters so often in the media, is often lost sight of completely. Like any other major world culture, Islam contains within itself an astonishing variety of currents and countercurrents. I would say that it is this extremely widespread attitude of questioning and skepticism towards age-old authority that characterizes the post-war world in both East and West. And it's that Huntington cannot handle and therefore resorts to the business of the clash of cultures and the clash of civilizations. What is described as Islam belongs to the discourse of Orientalism, a construction fabricated to whip up feelings of hostility and antipathy against a part of the world that happens to be of strategic importance for its oil, its threatening adjacence to Christianity, its formidable history of competition with the West. Yet this is a very different thing than what, to Muslims who live within its domain, Islam really is. There's a world of difference between Islam in Indonesia and Islam in Egypt. But the truly weakest part, and I conclude here, or the weakest part of the clash of cultures and civilizations thesis is the rigid separation assumed between them, despite the overwhelming evidence that today's world is in fact a world of mixtures, of migrations, and of crossings over, of boundaries traversed. There are no insulated cultures or civilizations. Any attempt made to separate them into the watertight compartments alleged by Huntington and his ilk does damage to their variety, their diversity, their sheer complexity of elements, their radical hybridity. The more insistent we are on the separation of cultures, the more inaccurate we are about ourselves and about others. Our most precious asset in the face of such a dire transformation of history is the emergence, not of a sense of clash, but a sense of community, understanding, sympathy, and hope, which is the direct opposite of what Huntington provokes. The language of group identity makes a particularly strident appearance from the middle to the end of the 19th century, as the culmination of decades of international competition between the great European and American powers for territories in Africa and Asia. In the battle for the empty spaces of Africa, the so-called Dark Continent, France and Britain, Germany, Belgium, Portugal, resort not only to force, but to a whole slew of theories and rhetorics for justifying their plunder. Perhaps the most famous of such devices is the French notion of the civilizing mission, la mission civilisatrice, a notion underlying which is the idea that some races and cultures have a higher aim in life than others. This gives the more powerful, the more developed, the more civilized, the higher, the right to colonize others, not in the name of brute force or plunder, both of which are standard components of the exercise, but in the name of a noble ideal. Conrad's most famous story, The Heart of Darkness, is an ironic, even terrifying enactment of this thesis that, as the narrator puts it, the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can bow down before and sacrifice to. In response to this sort of logic, two things occur. One is that competing imperial powers invent their own theory of cultural destiny in order to justify their actions abroad. Britain had such a theory, Germany had one, Belgium had one, and of course in the concept of manifest destiny, the United States had one too. These redeeming ideas dignify the practice of competition and clash, whose real purpose, as Conrad quite accurately saw, was self-aggrandizement, power, conquest, treasure, and unrestrained self-pride. The second thing that happens is that the lesser peoples, the objects of the imperial gaze, so to speak, respond by resisting their forcible manipulation and settlement.
Karen Armstrong, author of A History of God.
Pride of place in this practice is given to compassion. And it is an arresting fact that right across the board, in every single one of the major world faiths, compassion, the ability to feel with the other, in the way we've been thinking about this evening, is not only the test of any true religiosity, it is also what will bring us into the presence of what Jews, Christians, and Muslims call God or the divine. It is compassion, says the Buddha, which brings you to nirvana. Why? Because in compassion, when we feel with the other, we dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and we put another person there. Once we get rid of ego, then we're ready to see the divine. And in particular, every single one of the major world traditions has highlighted and has put at the core of their tradition what's become known as the Golden Rule. First propounded by Confucius 5 centuries before Christ, do not do to others what you would not like them to do to you. That, he said, was the central thread which ran through all his teaching and that his disciples should put into practice all day and every day. And it was the Golden Rule would bring them to the transcendent value that he called Ren, human-heartedness, which was a transcendent experience in itself. And this is absolutely crucial to the monotheisms too. There's a famous story about the great Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus. A pagan came to him and offered to convert to Judaism if the rabbi could recite the whole of Jewish teaching while he stood on one leg. Hillel stood on one leg and said, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the Torah. The rest is commentary." And this is an important point, I think, that you could not and must not confine your compassion to your own group, your own nation, your own co-religionists, your own fellow countrymen. You must have what one of the Chinese sages called Rian Ai, concern for everybody. Love your enemies, honor the stranger. We formed you, says the Quran, into tribes and nations so that you may know one another. And this universal outreach is getting subdued in the strident use of religion, abuse of religion, for nefarious gains. Make no mistake about it, religion is a kind of fault line. And when a conflict gets ingrained in a region, religion can get sucked in and become part of the problem.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Extremism is when I think you do not allow for a different point of view, and when you hold your view as being quite exclusive.
On August 18th, at the Ramada Hotel in central Jerusalem, leading Israeli rabbis gathered to defend the publication of a book by one of their peers that cited rabbinic sources to justify the killing of non-Jews, including innocent children and families.
There is no salvation in hell. There's no Savior in hell. There's no Bible in hell. There's no blood in hell. There's no altars in hell. There's no forgiveness in hell. Whatever goes to hell stays in hell.
Satan, be gone!
Like all religions, Islam has its share of extremists. Yet far from opposing such groups, the major Western powers have frequently supported them. The most notorious case remains Saudi Arabia, where people are routinely beheaded for crimes such as sorcery and witchcraft. In 2011, the Obama administration and the Saudis conducted the biggest arms deal in history. Islamic fundamentalists have consistently been empowered by the West, both as a divide-and-conquer stratagem and as a means of countering secular nationalist regimes which threaten control of oil supplies. This has been seen most recently in the proxy wars against Syria and Libya, where NATO-backed Islamists have caused thousands of deaths.
Retired U.S. General Wesley Clark speaks on Democracy Now! In 2007.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
So go through the countries again?
Well, starting with Iraq, then Syria and Lebanon, then Libya, then Somalia and Sudan, and then back to Iran.
The United States would indeed attack Iraq, but the people of Libya and Syria would have to wait until the next administration to receive the gift of American democracy.
Let's get it done. Let's arm these rebels. Let's give them a chance to fight.
A sentiment also supported by MSNBC's most liberal talk show hosts, Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell.
It seems to me there's a practical, war-making, tactical success that they believe they could have in this particular country.
Exactly. He kept describing himself as sort of acutely aware of the risks and the costs of America doing any sort of military intervention. And so you're exactly right.
I think we have to do it. It is a moral decision at this point.
The headline from Reuters yesterday, President Barack Obama has signed a secret order authorizing U.S. support for rebels seeking to depose Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his government. A U.S. government source acknowledged that under provisions of the presidential finding, the United States is collaborating with a secret command center operated by Turkey and its allies. Last week, Reuters reported that along with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, Turkey had established a secret base near the Syrian border to help direct vital military and communication support to Assad's opponents. So what you need to know, late last year when Senator John McCain co-wrote the National Defense Authorization Act and President Obama signed it into law, they crafted a law that gave the president the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force during the current armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and associated forces, including the power to indefinitely detain anyone caught supporting Al-Qaeda, which in this case is the president and members of Congress. To be clear, we're spending over $1 trillion, and more importantly, spilling the blood of thousands of American lives in Iraq and Afghanistan. then spending more American money and military power to, in some cases, help the same fighters overthrow another government.
Nafees Ahmed.
For the most part, this began in a generic form from around the 1960s, really took off, where we had, in places like Egypt, institutions like the Muslim Brotherhood, which were founded with the covert financial support of the CIA. And this is very well documented, it's not controversial anymore. And that doesn't mean that organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood from top down were simply kind of plants from Western intelligence services. On the contrary, there were movements inside Egypt which organically emerged as a result of struggles going on inside that country with, you know, combination of Western interference, secularization, the emergence of modernity, the struggle between kind of traditional and cultural ideas linked to Islam, the sense of grievance that occurred in terms of British colonization and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the way in which Muslims kind of responded to that across these different regions. So all of these complex things are what gave rise to these very different types of thinking. But certainly, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood is an example where movements that were led by ideologues like Hassan al-Banna, for example, and Said Qutb, who I don't think there's any reason to think that these particular individuals were in any way kind of, say, plants, for example. But the ideas that they developed were given financial mobilization and infrastructural support in a way that probably wouldn't have been possible without the input of the United States and Britain and other Western European powers. In the Middle East, you find that these virulent Islamist movements were supported as a way of countering both independent nationalist movements as well as movements that were kind of left-leaning. This whole process basically accelerated when the United States began to see Afghanistan as a major area of strategic influence. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor to the Carter administration, as well as people like Robert Helms, former director of the CIA, have both admitted that they began intelligence interference and military intelligence operations in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Afghanistan was considered to be a gateway to Eurasia. And Eurasia itself was also considered to be the basis for maintaining US hegemony. If you controlled Afghanistan, you could control Eurasia. If you controlled Eurasia, you would control world order. And this is simply because of, again, population, resources, geographic position. So these are all very imperial considerations, and Brzezinski actually articulates these ideas very candidly in his book, The Grand Chessboard. So this is why we kind of got involved in Afghanistan. But in the process, we funded, and by we I mean the United States, Britain, again Western European powers, even elements of the Muslim world who were allies of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. We funded these virulent kind of marginal groups in Afghanistan, and Osama bin Laden was involved in this process. He had connections with the CIA. He received funding from the CIA to facilitate the establishment of the Tora Bora complex, for example.
U.S. National Security Advisor Brzezinski flew to Pakistan to set about rallying resistance. He wanted to arm the Mujahideen without revealing America's role. On the Afghan border near the Khyber Pass, he urged the soldiers of God to redouble their efforts.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed.
This process continued throughout the post-Cold War period as a way of rolling back the Soviet Union, and it was paralleled again in the Middle East, where funding of the same kinds of movements accelerated across the Middle East in order to basically again roll back the Soviet influence but potential left-leaning interference in all of these countries.
In 1958, President Eisenhower expressed an internal discussion, since declassified, concern about what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, not by governments but by the people. The National Security Council explained same time the reasons for it. This is the highest planning body. They said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports dictatorships and blocks democracy and development, and that we do that so as to ensure control over the resources of the region. And furthermore, they went on to say that the perception is basically accurate, and that that's exactly what we should be doing, relying on the Muasher Doctrine. As long as people are quiet, everything's under control, it's fine.
During the Eisenhower administration, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles summed up the dominant view amongst American strategic planners. We must regard Arab nationalism as a flood which is running strongly. We cannot successfully oppose it, but we can put up sandbags around positions we must protect, the first being Israel and Lebanon, and the second being the oil positions around the Persian Gulf. During the Cold War, the new state of Israel was perceived as an important ally in the struggle against Arab independence. And the Israelis had their own imperial ambitions.
There's a quote from Albert Einstein from 1938. I should much rather see reasonable agreement with the Arabs on the basis of living together in peace than the creation of a Jewish state. Joel Koval, author of Overcoming Zionism.
You're faced in that sense with a terrible predicament if you're going to be a Zionist, and which is that you have to conquer the land that you say God gave it to you, that God gave you. And the conquest would be rationalized by the sufferings that you had received and the fact that you felt yourself divinely entitled to it. The Zionist movement goes back really to the beginnings of the 19th century, but it was only adopted by Jews out of a conflict and a crisis that they had towards the close of the 19th century. And that set forth for the Jews a choice, which was to develop a nationalism for themselves. It wasn't the only choice. I mean, a lot of other Jews decided to become very pious and just go to the religious traditions, or they decided to go westward and became very, very important in the history of United States immigration, or they became very much involved with Marxist and socialist movements. But there was this also fourth impulse, which was to become the bearer of an idea that they had to develop their nationalism. Ben-Gurion, and later Moshe Dayan, who was, you know, his chief of staff and the like, said, listen, if I were Arab, I would do everything possible to kick out the Jews. And, you know, but I'm a Jew, and we have this destiny, and we're going to take this country over. The early Zionists were interested in this, and they sent a couple of scouts to study the situation. And they cabled back in crypto language, but it was unmistakable, the following message: that the bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man. And the bride being the land that they saw for themselves, and the marriage being the brute fact that there were other people living there who had in fact inhabited that land. In fact, these people whom we call Palestinians had to some degree inhabited it ever since the destruction of the Jewish temple back in 70 AD, and they're probably the descendants of the original Jews, whereas the Jews who came at the end of the 19th century and through the 20th century were mainly Jews who developed in Eastern Europe or so Russian territory, such as my own family, called the Ashkenazim Jews. And we certainly had the religion, but there was no actual authentic national rootedness. And to take it over, it required ethnic cleansing. It's built into the logic. It's an iron necessity. It can wax, it can wane, it can take legal forms, it can take administrative forms, it can take economic forms. And then, of course, in 1947 and 48, it took terroristic and military forms and became the great Nakba, which is the catastrophe of Palestinian existence, when 800,000 Palestinians were violently expelled, 531 villages were destroyed, the memory of those villages was erased, and the like. So that's the foundational event, which happens to have been a crime, because it's a crime to take somebody else's land, and that's the essence of the matter.
And the video shows a map which illustrates Israeli territorial expansion. together with some footage of how that expansion is carried out, looking at rockets and other high-tech weaponry being used on the one side of the conflict, and the anger of the stone-throwing Palestinians faced with tanks and bulldozers, faced with tanks and bulldozers to destroy their homes. And the film cites the American Independent News Network that during Operation Cast Lead, the 2009 Israeli assault on Gaza, the death ratio grew to 155 Palestinian deaths for each Israeli casualty.
The imbalance is incredible. It's 100-1, basically. And yet somehow it's possible, given this kind of matrix that the history of being persecuted for, you know, for being Jewish in an anti-Semitic society, all these fears can be culled and drummed up, and strident government propaganda saying, you know, we're defending the integrity of the state of Israel. So a lot of, you know, it's amazing how people can turn truth on its head and believe that they are in fact the victim of a force, namely the Palestinians. I think Palestinians have very remarkable qualities. They said chiefly being able to endure the punishment that's been meted out to them. It's incredible that they are as forgiving and as benign a people as in fact they are. I know many, many Palestinians, and they are remarkable in the lack of vengeance. And of course they have their anger and their little sects within them, and some of them will do terrible things because that's human beings. But in any sense that this is a real threat to the state of Israel is just in the realm of madness and delusion. All governments have to justify what they're doing. They have to become legitimate and the like. And the worse they behave, the more strenuously they have to lie and distort reality in order to be legitimate. And this is, you know, what they're doing. And they somehow succeeded through a sustained propaganda campaign to persuade the majority of Israeli citizens that the Palestinians were the aggressors and a genuine threat to the state of Israel, which is absolute nonsense. State-structured racism. I mean, the racism is profound, and it is necessary given the basic logic of the social compact, the basic structure of the state. So it's impossible to avoid. So not only is it unavoidable, but it's inevitably going to get worse. And it is getting worse all the time. There's more racism in Israel, sociologically measured against the Palestinians. The IDF, the Israel Army, is increasingly violent against Palestinians in all respects. And the situation does not resolve, and it's heading towards an extremely calamitous outcome, though it's calamitous even in itself now.
In the 21st century, an increasing number of Jews are demanding a just peace with the Palestinians. Yet the Israeli government remains committed to war and expansion.
Diana Ralph from Independent Jewish Voices.
What are the roots of the war on terror as a concept? It was actually invented by Benjamin Netanyahu, who then became the Prime Minister of Israel, in 1979. Netanyahu had called a conference on international terrorism, and he coined the phrase international terrorism in 1979. And Bush Sr., who was then the head of the CIA, and George Shultz, who later became Secretary of State, were at this conference. At that conference, Netanyahu and Simon Peres and most of the other presenters, including Bush, proposed essentially the war on terror policies, which would characterize liberation resistance groups, anti-colonial resistance groups, as terrorists. For Netanyahu, it was the PLO, and it was Arabs and Palestinians who were to be characterized as terrorists. For Bush, it was the Sandinistas and Allende and people in El Salvador and resistance fighters in Indonesia and so on.
The infiltration into the Americas by terrorists, by outside interference, and those who aren't just aiming at El Salvador, but I think are aiming at the whole of Central and possibly later South America, and I'm sure eventually North America.
It worked so well that by 1984, the second conference on international terrorism was held not in Jerusalem, but in Washington, D.C. So that was one of the first seeds of planting the idea of characterizing Muslims and Arabs and Palestinians as terrorists. It's interesting, right after 9/11, Margaret Thatcher wrote an article that crowed saying Islam is the new Bolshevism. After the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. had a problem. They couldn't justify the massive military spending and the imperial controls and the bases and things, and the American people were clamoring for a peace dividend. In 1992, shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed and Bush Sr. was now president, he set up the DPG group, the Defense Policy Guidance Group, to come up with strategies for making the United States a permanent empire in the world, giving it permanent control. Dick Cheney was leading it, and Rumsfeld and Powell came up with two alternate scenarios. Rumsfeld's was selected. It was basically proposed taking over the Middle East and the Caspian Sea area. When that one was exposed by the New York Times, it became part of the reason that Bush Sr. was turfed out of office. It was a scandal. Shortly after that, I think in 1994-95, Zalmay Khalilzad was commissioned to write a piece under the direction of Brzezinski. He wrote this book, again, saying that the Caspian Sea area, which includes Afghanistan and the Middle East, both needed to be conquered in order for the U.S. to have permanent control. And again, Khalilzad said this would be a difficult sell to the American public and that you would need a pretext incident. It was the first time pretext incident was mentioned. What was happening at the same time was that the U.S. was maneuvering the Caspian Sea area, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, their minerals and their natural gas especially. And also they were trying to set up U.S. bases that would ring the area and control China, India, and the Soviet, and what had been the Soviet Union. In 1997, two things happened. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been the policy advisor under Carter, he wrote The Grand Chessboard. And this is an amazingly Machiavellian book that's really worth reading. And basically he said, if you control the Middle East and the Caspian Sea area, you control the world, because basically you're in the middle of Europe and China and Africa and Asia.
So Dr. Brzezinski, I can't say enough about his contribution to our country. Somebody who has over decades trained some of the most prominent foreign policy specialists, not just in the Democratic Party, but has trained a number who ended up in the Republican Party as well. He is one of our most outstanding scholars, one of our most outstanding thinkers. He has proven to be an outstanding friend and somebody who I've learned an immense amount from.
And the video quotes Karl Rove, consultant and policy advisor to George Bush, is saying, "We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. While you're studying that reality, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors."
The last thing, of course, was the RAD, Rebuilding America's Defenses, put out by the Project for the New American Century, which literally said, we reaffirm the values of the Defense Policy Guidance Report, and we're basically expanding it. And it laid out everything, all the major policy changes that became part of Bush's War on Terror. Also in that, they said we would need a new Pearl Harbor-type incident in order to sell it. The Taliban took over Kabul and established a government with, and only with, the support of the United States and the Saudi government. And the U.S. was actively working with them. And then the Taliban did two mistakes. One was that they destroyed the poppy fields and banned heroin. And the second thing that they did was that they started demanding a fair share of the proceeds from the Unocol business. And the U.S. in July 2001, and shortly before the 9/11 attacks, told them, we'll either carpet you with gold, if you agree, or we'll carpet you with bombs. Shortly after that, the U.S. started amassing aircraft carriers and having military exercises all around Afghanistan, the biggest buildup in the Caspian Sea area in history.
Prior to 9/11?
Prior to 9/11, okay. In the lead-up to 9/11, so that it was possible, that's why it was possible to launch the war against Afghanistan so soon.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
And to contrast the earlier images of the Pearl Harbor attack, we have images of the attack on the World Trade Center. The film reminds us that in the weeks after 9/11, the Taliban agreed to hand over Osama bin Laden to a neutral country for prosecution if the United States government provided evidence of his involvement in the attacks, and the Bush administration refused. Following the establishment of the 9/11 Commission, family members of the 9/11 attack victims submitted a series of questions to authorities. 80% of these questions remain unanswered. On October the 26th, 2001, an incredibly expansive and detailed piece of legislation known as the Patriot Act was passed, effectively eradicating much of the Bill of Rights. According to former counter-terrorism czar Richard Clarke, the Patriot Act, quote, had been sitting in the drawers of the Justice Department for the last 20 years, waiting for the event where they would pull it out, unquote. 1 week before the passage of the bill, anthrax spores were sent via mail to politicians and media figures, accompanied by a note reading, "Death to America and death to Israel." The anthrax was later traced to the U.S. biological warfare facility at Fort Detrick. After the invasion, the U.S. installed former UNOCAL employee Hamid Karzai as Afghanistan's new dictator. Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali, was later revealed to be one of the world's biggest heroin traffickers. In 2007, Joint Chiefs Chairman Peter Pace reiterated Dick Cheney's claim that the war on terror is likely to last not years, but decades. The penultimate part of counterintelligence, but I thought rather than start on the last part, I'll use the rest of the show to rebroadcast an episode which looks in more detail at what went on at Pearl Harbor. This is episode 116 of Unwelcome Guests, Fooling Most of the People Most of the Time. Thanks to Mike McCormack for this interview. He's interviewing Robert Stinnett, a former American sailor, an author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor.
What motivated you to write your book, Day of Deceit?
I was in the Navy in World War II, and we were always told that our Japanese warships were sighted by our submarines. But in 1982, I read a book that changed all that, because a book called At Dawn We Slept mentioned a U.S. Navy monitor station in Pearl Harbor that was operating prior to Pearl Harbor, you know, December 7th. That immediately called my attention to the fact that, hey, we were listening into the Japanese naval frequencies prior to December 7th or Pearl Harbor. So I wanted to do a news story for my paper that was the Oakland Tribune. And so I went to my editor. He gave me permission to go to Pearl Harbor and check this station out. And the space was still there. And I met cryptographers who told me about the operation, you know, prior to December 7th. So I had the confirmation that we were monitoring Japanese warships prior to December 7th. And if that was true, then we certainly had to know about the Pearl Harbor attack and the warships coming to Pearl Harbor. So that started my quest. And then to get more information, I had to file Freedom of Information requests with the Navy to see the actual intercepts of these Japanese messages. By intercepts, I mean the Japanese would transmit the messages over the radio, then we would intercept them. By we, I mean these radio cryptographers. So I wanted to see these the actual messages. So I had to file Freedom of Information Act requests with them, with the Navy, and they were reluctant to disclose too much of that. But I did get a few of them. But I got the greatest bulk, it was in January 1995. That was almost 10 years after I had started the quest to, first of all, to see the station, talk with the cryptographers, and then get the messages.
So when you first started your adventure, did you expect to find what you ended up finding?
Well, I expected that I would get to see some of the messages. By the messages, I mean the intercepted Japanese naval messages. And I was looking forward to that, and I thought that that might make a good nonfiction book, because I could describe to readers what we were intercepting, what the Japanese were saying. But I really found a gold mine, I would say a smoking gun, when the Navy finally released these records to me in January 1995 in that National Archives. And in that, I came across a secret memo that prepared by the Navy that called for provoking Japan to attacking us at Pearl Harbor. And that, I realized, was the Pearl Harbor smoking gun, if that was true. And so I spent the rest of 1995 checking the records, checking the Navy records that showed that President Roosevelt personally adopted this Navy memo that called for 8 provocations to be aimed at Japan. And these provocations started in the fall of 1940 and continued right up to the attack. And the president actually signed the orders for most of these provocations. And the whole idea of these provocations was to do away with American civilian interest in not going into Europe's war. They wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. This is what it was called in 1940 and 41. There was a huge isolation movement in this country, led by Charles Lindbergh, that wanted nothing to do with what they called Europe's war. So this was the plan that the Navy adopted. It was to sort of a backdoor approach to get us into the war with, really, Germany, which was an ally of Japan in 1940 and 41. Now, this is actually what happened. This provocation plan was adopted, and it worked. Japan immediately started preparing to attack us at Pearl Harbor, and the plan first leaked out in January 1941 to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, who notified Washington that Japan was planning a carrier attack on Pearl Harbor. And this was dated in January 1941. Then our cryptographers discovered the Japanese carrier force in April 1941, and then they just followed it all the way through to the attack. So they knew that the U.S. Navy and the highest levels of the government knew that Japan's carrier force was headed towards Pearl Harbor, because Japan's admirals, for some reason, this could not keep quiet on the radio. They broke radio silence, and our radio direction finders and our cryptographers located them in the North Pacific and also in the Central Pacific. So we detected 2 forces coming towards Pearl Harbor, one in the North Pacific, that was the carrier force, and the other one was in the Central Pacific, and this was the 30 submarines headed towards Pearl Harbor. So this information went to President Roosevelt and the military there in Washington, but they cut off this information from the Hawaiian commanders so that they would not interfere with this Japanese overt act of war. This is what that message, or this memorandum, I should say, in 1940 called for, was to get Japan to commit an overt act of war. That was our strategy, both in 1940 and 41. And that's what happened. And they wanted a clean-cut overt act of war to unite this country with this outrageous act at Pearl Harbor. And then it worked. As you all know, the attack took place December 7th, 1941, and the next day, December 8th, millions of Americans flocked to the recruiting offices of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and joined the military. And then civilians went to work in the shipyards, turning out the war materials.
Prior to the publication of your book and you're discovering this document in your Freedom of Information Act packets, none of this information had been known publicly, correct?
That is right. This provocation memo had been kept secret. It was locked in Navy vaults in Crane, Indiana, in a steel vault so that it would have maximum security.
So, and you discovered it in 1995, and then when was your book first published?
The book was published in December 1999.
So it's still pretty fresh insights and info into this whole picture of what really happened.
Well, that's right, Mike, and I'm still getting more information, about the breaking of the Japanese Navy Code. I want to emphasize to your listeners that I'm talking about the Navy Code. It was always admitted that we had broken the Japanese diplomatic codes, but the fact that we had broken the Japanese Navy Code was withheld from Congress and in the public until 1995, when I first started following this trail.
Tell us about the man who came up with the 8-point plan.
The author of the 8-point provocation plan was Lieutenant Command Arthur McCollum, and he was head of the Far East desk of Navy intelligence in Washington. He was had a powerful position. He was also the routing officer for President Roosevelt. By routing officer, I mean he sent all these secret messages directly to President Roosevelt from his command post in the Navy Department, and they were delivered to the White House, sometimes by Commander McCollum himself.
Okay, and what was his background?
He was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was born in Japan to Baptist minister parents, so he spoke Japanese, knew their culture before he even knew, American culture. So for the first 8 years of his life, he was living in Japan, played with Japanese children, and, as I say, spoke the language and knew their culture. Then his family returned to the United States, and he joined, he was appointed to the Naval Academy in Washington, graduated, and then was sent to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo in 1923. That was his first Navy job, you might say. And he was assigned sort of a social position, and he taught the future emperor of Japan and the court to do the Charleston. He was very close to the Japanese crown.
So it sounds like he had excellent insight and perspective into Japanese culture.
That's right. And so he could understand the Japanese mind, how they would work, and how that you could use provocations to tick off the militarist of the Japanese nation. And that's what he did. That was the whole idea of the provocations, was to get the militarists of the Japanese nation to seize control of the civilian government. And that's what happened. And we could follow that, their actions, by intercepting the messages, both diplomatic and military.
Okay, so can you give us some details into what the 8-point plan was?
Yes. They were numbered A through H. And the first was to send a division of United States cruisers into Japanese territorial waters. And that was done. There were three voyages into the Japanese territorial waters in the Central Pacific, and then also one went into the Inland Sea, the Bungo Strait, which is the main entrance to Japan's Inland Sea, and that's where all the Japanese naval operations were practiced. Another one is to cut off all Japanese oil, their access to oil in the Southeast Asia, Borneo, and Vietnam, and Indonesia, which at that time was controlled by the Dutch and also the British. And the British and the Dutch also agreed to go along with this embargo. Another one was to keep the fleet stationed at Pearl Harbor as a lure to this Japanese attack. And that was done. Then also to send United States submarines into the Far East. And then the final one was in July 1941, just about 6 months before Pearl Harbor, and the president signed an executive order. President Roosevelt signed it, and he ordered a complete embargo against Japan, cutting them off from oil. Their bank accounts were frozen, and this is really what set Japan off on a point of no return. That's when they started all out for war. All of this information, this 8-point memorandum and plan, the overt act of war plan, were all withheld from Congress, both in the 1945 investigation and also again in 1995, just a few years ago, the Congress reopened it. So all of this was withheld. So it's just unassailable. There's no question about it that we were monitoring the Japanese fleet. We had 22 monitor stations in the Pacific, including there in Seattle was the headquarters for the West Coast Communications Intelligence of the Navy. It was headquarters on Bainbridge Island there in across Seattle at Elliott Bay. And so this headquarters had stations at Dutch Harbor, Alaska, all the way down to Imperial Beach near San Diego. And these stations were getting radio direction finder bearings when the Japanese warships broke radio silence. You see that if you break radio silence, then you can locate the ship by these radio direction finders. And one of these was at Dutch Harbor, Alaska.
Some people state that perhaps Roosevelt didn't actually receive any of these documents, that this might have all been done by, let's say, hierarchy in the military. But you actually believe that Roosevelt had to have known.
Well, the president was getting these messages direct from Commander McCollum, who was his routing officer. And on November 27th, President Roosevelt issued the order to the Pacific commanders, both in Hawaii and in the Philippines, and told them to stand aside, don't go on an offensive, remain in a defensive mode, because the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. Those are the exact words of the president. We've got that order, is published in my book, and that was the controlling plan that was originated by Commander McCollum, the overt act of war plan.
And that's where I'm going to leave it this week, due to time. If you'd like to finish listening to that interview, you can do so at unwelcomeguests.net/116. All the back issues are available online, and I hope I've inspired you to have a browse and inform yourself or refresh your memory of some dissident thought on important topics of the day, as well as the good work of Scott Noble in producing the film. This comes to you courtesy of Olivier, who notified me about its release. I appreciate all the suggestions you make for material for the show. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can do so at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Will Go. The lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Help these poor workers, the rich will.